This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, January 31st. I'm Max Pringle. Coming up, new revelations of corporate malfeasance in the ongoing Enron scandal. Australia offers Afghan refugees a one-way ticket off the continent. Thousands of anti-corporate globalization activists gather in New York City and Porto Alegre, Brazil. These stories and more coming up on Free Speech Radio News. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, in a speech today, said the United States must be prepared for surprise attacks that are vastly more deadly than the one on September 11th. At the National Defense University, Rumsfeld cautioned the U.S. not to make the mistake of assuming terrorism is the only threat. He said the military must prepare to protect against the unknown, the uncertain, the unseen, and the unexpected. U.S. troops formally began their mission in the Philippines today as protests in that country continued. Girlie Lee now has more from Manila.
Just before the opening of the training exercise in the southern city of Zamboanga, about 30 people held a rally outside the military headquarters there. They burned a replica of the American flag and told the American soldiers to go home, that they don't need them there. What they need are food, employment, housing. The tension in Manila was quite higher than what happened in Zamboanga City. The protesters in Manila tried to enter the American embassy compound. The policemen were hitting the protesters with batons and shields, but there were no arrests made and no major injuries were reported from the incident. It does not necessarily mean that there are going to be big numbers. There are going to be rallies every day to show that they do not approve of this training exercise and that the Americans should go home.
That was Free Speech Radio News correspondent Girlie Lee Now. Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has raised the level of public discussion over his personal vendetta against Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat after comments he made in a newspaper interview will be released tomorrow. Inigo Gilmore reports from Jerusalem.
Mr. Sharon told the Israeli Daily Mariv, "To tell the truth, I'm sorry we didn't eliminate him." His comments have been seized upon as evidence that the unfinished business of the past between Sharon and Arafat has become a central motivating factor in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Senior Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat, responding to Mr. Sharon's remarks, said for prime ministers to announce openly their gangster intention is a reflection of what kind of government we're dealing with. As defense minister, Mr. Sharon oversaw the 1982 invasion of Lebanon. After being besieged by Israeli forces in Beirut, Arafat and the PLO leadership eventually quit the city for exile in Tunis. Mr. Sharon has always refused to shake Mr. Arafat's hand, and since he came to office, he has never once met with him. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Inigo Gilmore in Jerusalem.
Munich police are trying to stop protesters from marching this weekend during an international security conference, and demonstrators have taken them to court. From Munich, Patrick Beckett reports.
Several thousand demonstrators are expected to arrive in Munich tomorrow to express their criticism of NATO. But the Munich police have asked city authorities not to grant a permit for the demonstration. Bavarian intelligence agents claim to have evidence that between 2,000 and 3,000 demonstrators intent on violence are coming to Munich from Germany and other European countries. Demonstration organizers took the case to court, arguing that German law protects the right to demonstrate. The administrative court must now decide whether to uphold this law or cancel the demonstration permit. A decision is expected tomorrow morning. The annual Munich Security Conference unites military, government, and business leaders to ostensibly discuss security issues throughout the world. I'm Patrick Beckett in Munich for Free Speech Radio News.
And finally, landowners and environmentalists are heavily criticizing a massive rail expansion planned by the Dakota, Minnesota, and Eastern Railroad. Randy McKay has more from Wyoming.
The rail project would be the biggest since the Lincoln administration and would consist of 280 miles of new track running from the coal mines of Wyoming's Powder River Basin to power plants in the east. Some landowners along the proposed route have already announced they will challenge the STB's decision, saying the railroad would destroy their ranches. One rancher says the plan is also redundant and unnecessary since there are already two carriers taking coal out of Wyoming to the east. She also says more coal production will harm the environment. The president of the DM&E, Kevin Schieffer, says the project is a crucial part of President Bush's energy plan.
The single biggest transportation need in the energy world is for a new railroad into the Powder River Basin, or new rail capacity into the Wyoming Powder River Basin.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Randy McKay in Laramie, Wyoming.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Potentially damning revelations for board members of the embattled energy trading giant Enron today. Just released minutes of Enron board meetings suggest that board members knew as far back as 4 years ago that the company was shifting its debt to subsidiary companies to keep the stock price high. That doesn't bode well for Enron's ex-CEO Ken Lay, who makes his first appearance before congressional investigators Monday. Meanwhile, Enron refuses to divulge information about its subsidiaries. These developments and the revelation of an Enron wish list for national energy priorities have consumer advocates urging Congress to scuttle the Bush energy proposal. Joshua Chaffin reports from Washington.
The newly discovered minutes to Enron board meetings suggest that board members not only knew about the moving of the company's debt into partner companies, but that they approved those actions. So far, only Enron's just-resigned CEO Ken Lay is scheduled to testify before congressional investigators. Enron's former chief financial officer, Andrew Fasto, has declined the invitation, and former CEO Jeffrey Skilling has, too. The chair of Monday's Senate committee, Democrat Byron Dorgan of North Dakota, called on Enron executives to start cooperating.
The shroud of secrecy that has surrounded so much of what this corporation has done will not be allowed to stand. We must receive all of the documents, all of the investments in these corporations off the books partnerships in order to understand what happened. And we renew our call again today to this corporation. We have requested it on two occasions before. The Congress will insist on receiving all of the information about these off the books partnerships. Secrecy will not be allowed to stand.
And the Enron documents keep coming. A memo from Enron to Vice President Cheney at the height of the California energy crisis suggests the company heavily influenced the Bush administration's handling of the price spikes, shaping public policy in ways that would earn the company billions of dollars. Doug Heller of California's Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights has been claiming for the last 2 years that the Texas oil companies are in bed with the Bush White House. Heller says now he's been proven right.
This memo is a smoking gun. The Bush administration was taking word for word, almost, Enron's priorities and making that the nation's priorities. The Bush administration was working for Enron against the public interest. That's as clear as can be when you read this memo, because when the administration put out its national energy policy, it was cribbing language from an Enron memo that was handed to the vice president just a month before. It is as damning evidence as we have seen to this point, showing the close relationship between the Enron Corporation and the Bush administration.
Among other things, the memo from Enron recommends to Cheney that the federal regulators not impose price caps on power, which could have cut energy prices for California consumers. California Governor Gray Davis was a vocal advocate for those federal price caps. Davis spokesman Steve Maviglio says the memo from Enron to Vice President Cheney explains why California never got the administration's attention.
Well, we've known all along that the administration had adopted the Ken Lay Kool-Aid advice on deregulation. We believe this might be further evidence of that, and the governor's call for an investigation by FERC, the federal regulators, to check it out.
In Washington, a coalition of consumer and environmental groups is trying to keep the Senate from passing a Bush energy plan chock full of subsidies for energy companies like Enron.
ExxonMobil recently released its earnings for the fourth quarter of 2001. This energy giant's profit is projected at $15.5 billion. Smaller corporations are also doing well. Halliburton and Amerada Hess saw significant profits in the last quarter of 2001. Nevertheless, both of these companies could potentially benefit greatly at a cost to taxpayers of $3.9 billion over 8 years. Energy lobbyists are drilling for Washington dollars, and they have struck gold.
Sina Swisher has been studying the House version of the Bush energy plan on behalf of a nonprofit group called Taxpayers for Common Sense. Yesterday, the General Accounting Office announced it's suing Vice President Dick Cheney for failing to reveal with whom he met in devising the energy plan. It's only clear that he met with no consumer or environmental groups. The Bush energy plan has passed the House of Representatives and is expected to come up for vote in the Senate in the next 2 weeks. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Australia today offered to pay Afghan asylum seekers under guard in refugee camps to go home following a two-week protest by detainees against Canberra's hard line against illegal immigrants. A hunger strike by over 200 Afghans at the Woomera Detention Center in the southern Australian desert ended on Wednesday, but headlines about detainees sewing their lips and attempting suicide has cast an uncomfortable spotlight on the government's mandatory detention policy. Prime Minister John Howard said Australia would provide financial help to send back and resettle any of the 1,100 or so Afghans held in Australia or in refugee camps set up in nearby Pacific nations who were found not to be refugees. Rachel Maher reports from Melbourne.
If I say Woomera, Woomera is worse than anything. I believe there is a hell. And when I was in there for 1 year, believe me, I couldn't sleep at the night.
The words of Morteza, an Iranian refugee, currently detained inside the Villawood Detention Centre in Sydney, Australia. Yesterday in New York, Australia's Prime Minister John Howard was negotiating the future of Australia's Afghan detainees with Afghanistan's interim leader, Hamid Karzai. Meanwhile, asylum seekers inside the Woomera Detention Centre in outback South Australia agreed to end their 16-day hunger strike. The end to the immediate crisis inside the centre was negotiated by the federal government-appointed Detention Centre Advisory Group, who have apparently assured detainees that changes will be made to the conditions they currently endure. As Morteza explains, the conditions inside the Woomera Detention Centre are the worst of the six centres in Australia.
In Woomera, I saw so many things. I didn't see it never in my life. They put us in there and they hit us. Even when we complain about the food, they hit us. Officers, they hit us. And when we complain, we say, why you hit us? Here is free country. We can't complain about anything. And they put us in one locked room for the weeks, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and we cannot do anything in there. And after in there, they hit us and they put us, they bring back us to the detention. And after that, when we want contact to police and something like that, we need a phone call. Even there is no phone call, even no mail, no phone call, no fax machine. How we can complain to police?
While human rights activists greet an end to the immediate crisis, it is hardly the end of the problems with both the detention of asylum seekers who enter this country by boat and with Australia's strict anti-immigration border policies. Marion Lay is the president of the Independent Council of Refugee Advocacy, and she explains.
Unless, you know, the government does change its policy and recognise that holding people in long-term detention is not a viable, then I think, you know, we're going to continue probably to see protests, and certainly you're going to see people in the community, human rights activists and so on, and people like myself are going to be always questioning whether there is a need to keep people, well, in fact, we would just say there is no need to keep people long-term and they should be released into the community, as are people who come here by air, into the community until their applications are processed.
Meanwhile, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has called on Australia to accept more refugees from Afghanistan and the Middle East. Australia has accepted no refugees by boat since implementing fierce military border policies after the Tampa crisis late last year, a fact which causes great concern for human rights groups. Andrea Maksimovich from the campaign No One Is Illegal gives this analysis.
The fact that the Australian government has chosen to focus and put an emphasis on spending lots of money on a military solution to the problem, out of whack with the real long-term solutions, which is to actually accept the refugees and allow them to live in Australia. And what is happening is that the government is exporting its penal colony approach to refugees to other countries. Smaller Pacific nations that for the reasons of problems of their own economy, are being forced to accept the Australian government's solution. In essence, the Australian government is bribing the smaller Pacific nations to take on the punitive approach to refugees, even though the populations of those islands have been quite forward in saying that they do not accept John Howard's approach to refugees. They do not want to keep them locked up in detention centres.
It is widely acknowledged that the protest actions have increased the national and international focus on this issue, and hunger strikes and other forms of protest are continuing both inside and outside the detention centres around the country. While Australia's federal government has finally enabled an advisory group to communicate directly with detainees, it remains clear that a long-term and satisfactory solution to the crisis is distinctly in the hands of the Prime Minister, who remains inflexible on this issue, refusing, in his own words, to be blackmailed by the detainees. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rachel Maher in Melbourne, Australia.
More than 3,000 of the world's business elite are kicking off the World Economic Forum in New York City today. The forum is far from its traditional home of Davos, Switzerland. Officially, the decision was taken by the forum's founder, Klaus Schwab, as a gesture of solidarity with New York following the September 11th attacks. But the spiraling expense of dealing every year with thousands of protesters, at what they see as a private club for global elites means the government there has come to see it as a burden. Thousands are on the streets today in New York. There has been some reported vandalism at local chain stores and several arrests. Scott Harris reports from New York City.
As the World Economic Forum opened today at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, 4,000 police assigned to protect 2,500 corporate leaders and their political allies have swarmed the area, blocking off streets to traffic. Similar to what's occurred at other recent global summit meetings, thousands of labor, environmental, and student activists from around the U.S. and the world are planning to greet the elite delegates. A major protest is planned for Saturday. Street theater and several conferences on the theme of Another World is Possible are also being held over the next several days. New Yorkers still recovering from the September 11th terror attacks have been warned by the police department that they will deal harshly with violent demonstrators. Media outlets, meanwhile, have saturated papers and television screens with images of clashes between police and protesters at previous international summits in Seattle, Quebec, and Genoa. But groups organizing demonstrations here are predicting that while protests will be creative and militant, they will remain peaceful. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Scott Harris in New York City.
The signs are not positive, even if the immediate threat of war between India and Pakistan has been averted. India has rejected the latest Pakistani proposals for de-escalation of tensions. Cross-border shelling in the southern part of Jammu and Kashmir remains a daily occurrence, as are reports of skirmishes between Indian security forces and Kashmiri militants. The state itself remains sealed off from the rest of the country. No phone or internet connections since more than a month now. Kashmir remains now, like before, under the shadow of the gun. But the mood seems to be changing since the January 12th landmark speech of Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf. This is the first of two reports from Srinagar, the summer capital of Indian-administered Kashmir. From Free Speech Radio News reporter Sputnik Kalambi.
The winter snows seem to have cast a relative damper on separatist militancy in the Kashmir Valley. The huge army presence is another reason. Still on maximum alert, India's security forces rule the streets of Srinagar. Fear, anger, resentment, resignation, they're still there. But there's also a perceptible change in the political atmosphere since Parvez Musharraf's avowed intention to crack down on terrorism, including on those who fight in the name of Kashmir. There have been mixed reactions in Kashmir to the Musharraf speech, explains Bashir Manzar, editor of Kashmir Images. Hope that the crackdown on armed militancy will bear dividends in Kashmir, misgivings about Pakistan's change in policy, fear that after the Taliban, it'll be the Kashmiris' turn to be ditched by Islamabad.
They know this violence was brought here by Pakistan. Kashmiris don't grow guns in their own farms and fields. It has come from Pakistan. So now the Pakistan says that gun is no solution to Kashmir. It means that way it hurts somewhere. But you know, when after September 11, America declared what it says, a war against terrorism, and Musharraf joined that war, there was a feeling in Kashmir that if Musharraf can do this to Taliban, he can do it to Kashmiri militants too, and that has happened now. Means that way Kashmiris feel a little bit hurt that this is not our thing. It was Pakistan's thing. And now Pakistan means, why then these 50 or 40,000 whatever boys were killed? Who is responsible for it?
Certainly not Pakistan, says Aga Ahmad Ali. Aga Sahib, as most people call him affectionately, is one of the grand old men of Kashmir, a retired professor with a long memory. He remembers vividly how the Muslims of Kashmir prevented a bloodbath of Hindus in the valley during the madness of partition 50 years ago. All of India's sins of omission and commission have come home to roost in Kashmir, he says. Unfortunately, India is acting like a sore winner instead of reacting generously to Musharraf's speech.
Poor Musharraf has had to eat the very spit that Ziaul-Haq shot at Afghanistan and Russia. It's eating your own spit, you know. Training people whom you're now killing or antagonizing. At that time, a little more generosity, a little more courtesy is required to enable Musharraf to go whole hog to destroy the roots of violence that have been created in Pakistan.
Umar Farooq is the young Mirwais, the leader of Kashmiri Muslims and former chairman of the Hurriyat, the political wing of the separatist movement. He puts a brave face on Musharraf's speech, stressing that he'd again pledged moral and diplomatic support to Kashmiris. But he admits the Kashmir issue has been exploited by religious extremists.
I, as a member of the Hurriyat, not only as a member of Hurriyat, but also as a head of Kashmiri Muslims in Kashmir, firmly believe that it's a political issue, it's a political problem, and it needs a political settlement. So, yes, I mean, the Kashmir issue has been, you know, exploited by many people in Pakistan and around the world, and Islam has been exploited in the wrong sense.
An answer that begs the question that if the Hurriyat feels Islamic extremists have given the Kashmir struggle a bad name, why didn't they take the initiative to sever ties with such groups instead of waiting for Musharraf to spell out future policy?
We said that, you know, we want to carry on this process, and we want to tell the Mujahideen and the militants to reciprocate to this gesture. Let we be allowed to go to Pakistan and talk to these groups and take them into confidence and somehow resolve the problem. Unfortunately, we were not allowed. Even today, you know, from time to time, Hurriyat has come up with proposals in which we have said that we are willing to tell and talk to the Mujahideen, to the militants, to stop their activities, you know, in Jammu and Kashmir, if the government of India is ready for a political dialogue on this issue. But unfortunately, there has never been any indication by the government of India that they are willing to solve the problem politically rather than going on, you know, militarily.
Sputnik Kilambi in Srinagar for Free Speech Radio News.
That green tinge you often see on wooden fences, decks, and playground equipment indicates that the wood has been treated with a chemical called CCA, chromated copper arsenate. It's used to preserve outdoor wood from insects and the elements. CCA is 22% arsenic by weight. Arsenic, known to cause cancer in humans, can leach from CCA-treated wood. That's a big concern to some environmentalists who believe that CCA-treated wood is a hazard to children who play on decks and playground equipment made from it, while the Environmental Protection Agency investigates the matter. Environmentalists and the wood-preserving industry are at odds over how well consumers are being informed of the possible risks of CCA. More from Kelia Ramirez.
CCA is the only use of arsenic as a pesticide approved by the EPA. Bill Walker, West Coast Vice President for the Environmental Working Group, which favors a ban on CCA, says the way children behave makes them more vulnerable to arsenic that leaches from CCA-treated wood.
Studies have shown that children who are playing put their hands in their mouths an average of about 100 times an hour. I have a 3-year-old daughter myself at home, and I've actually seen her lean over to a little pool of water on our deck and drink from the water.
According to Walker, the long-term risk of cancer for children exposed to arsenic in wood is unacceptably high.
We have calculated that the average amount of arsenic available for uptake from a piece of wood could increase the lifetime risk of cancer for approximately 1 in 100 children. That is far, far above the standards that we set for almost all other carcinogens in the marketplace. Most of them are regulated to a relative risk of 1 in 1 million, and this is 1 in 100.
There is currently no standard for permissible arsenic levels in wood. The EPA is doing a comprehensive risk assessment of CCA to see if it meets current health and safety standards for children and adults. A draft report is due out in the spring. The EPA has the power to ban CCA, but the American Wood Preservers Institute, the national trade organization for the wood preserving industry, hopes that the government will leave CCA alone. Mel Pine is spokesperson for the AWPI.
We don't see a reason, based on the science to date, that government should be involved in making this choice for people, but it certainly is a choice that people have available. They can choose one of the alternatives. They're a little more expensive, but they have similar qualities for residential uses like decks and playgrounds.
Everybody knows arsenic is poison, and it turns out to be a human carcinogen. We may not know that a kid keeled over from something, but why add more?
Well, we're not adding more. That's the arsenic that's already there that's being basically recycled. We're not creating the arsenic.
No, but I mean in terms of adding more exposure opportunities.
Well, again, I mean, people are certainly free to choose to answer that question by choosing alternatives. There are alternatives available, and in the playset market, I think many playset companies. If you go out and buy a playset today, I think many playset companies are choosing to use the alternatives.
Sustainably harvested hardwoods, recycled plastic, or wood treated with ACQ, alkaline copper quat, and CBA, copper boron azole, are alternatives to arsenic. ACQ and CBA are not quite as readily available as CCA and cost a bit more. Are people who are choosing CCA getting the information they need to handle it safely? Consumers buying arsenic-treated wood should be able to get a safety information sheet at the store. But when Free Speech Radio News visited a retail lumber store near San Francisco, we found it difficult to get the information. We found it printed on warning tags stapled to the ends of pieces of wood, stacked in a way that the tags were not visible. The tags themselves were 3 inches long, 1 inch high, and crammed with tiny print. Another display had 2 5-by-7-inch cards directing the consumer to a toll-free number or a website. Several employees didn't even know what a consumer safety information sheet was. Bill Walker of the Environmental Working Group says a nationwide test produced a similar result.
None of the testers who went into 18 different stores nationwide was offered any information. Frequently, when they asked about the information, the employees didn't know about it, and the safety sheets, which are supposed to be passed out, are made available as part of a voluntary industry consumer education program, were not available.
A Consumer's Guide to Arsenic-Free Playground Equipment and an arsenic-free lumber locator are available at www.healthybuildingoneword.net. The site also offers a low-cost arsenic testing kit for home use. The Consumer Safety Information Sheet is available in English and Spanish at www.ccasafetyinfo.com, a website run by the American Wood Preservers Institute. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kelly Ramirez.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Max Pringle. Thanks for listening.